Thank you for water. My neighbor was outside when I got home from the airport today, because I'm just back from Boston. And she listened to my voice and she said, "You better, if you're giving a talk tonight, you better drink some water." I guess it was dry. So thank you for water. And good evening, and thank you for being here. It feels like more of a discussion-sized group, but I'll say some things, and with a little luck, we'll have time for some discussion as well. It is good to be back home with you all. Some of you know that my brother, before he died, completed a book about vision, about the neurobiology of vision and what's been discovered over the course of his long career. And he had, you know, little epigrams at the head of each chapter. And at the head of one chapter was a quote from Darwin that says, "It is not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change." We got change, huh? And this time, this particular week, feels kind of thick with it, momentous, a change time. I'm home from the ritual of parting from my brother, but you know, here we are today celebrating the life and gifts and teaching of Dr. King, and which offers us a chance to rededicate ourselves to the work of peace and justice. Renewal. And on Saturday, this Saturday is the Lunar New Year, and we'll be having a ceremonial gathering Saturday morning for the New Year. And in our practice, this depth of winter time can be a time of deep curiosity about our lives. They go, they become changing, and a time of welcome, both welcoming the more familiar great round of life, and the unknown and the unwelcomable, what seems unwelcomable. And in our community, a time of investigating by doing. It feels very much like a time for inquiry in so many different realms, and within our tradition and our Zen community, a time of investigating by doing. What's foundational? What's truly the wellspring of our way? And so, in particular, this evening, and for longer than this evening, I'm interested in bringing one fundamental foundational koan right in next to Dr. King's call in a talk that some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, the talk he gave to the Unitarian Universalist gathering in 1966 called "Don't Sleep Through the Revolution." And so we have, so the fundamental koan I want to bring in is one that John Tarrant sort of lit up in a wonderful, wonderful piece that he wrote. Someone asks, "When times of great difficulty visit us, how should we meet them?" And that teacher responded, "Welcome." So what's that welcome? What is welcome in a time like this? What does that look like for us? And how do our fundamental practices, our precepts, our sutras, and how do our koans and our meditation provide transformative encounters with our lives to enable us to be open-hearted without being gullible? How are these practices agents of the kind of change that is not about fixing ourselves and others, but about opening sky in our hearts? Action so free that their imprint is like bird tracks in the sky. I don't mean, I hope you know, that we'll analyze this. You know, that would be sort of like dissecting frogs in elementary school or something. But that we'll perform the experiments ourselves. We'll do it on ourselves, in ourselves, with ourselves. So next to that fundamental koan, when in times of great difficulty, what's helpful? Welcome. Next to that, I want to hold Dr. King's "Don't Sleep Through the Revolution." So let's see what happens when we put this together. That was May 18th, 1966, in Hollywood, Florida. That was about when I was graduating from high school. And there was so much going on. There was so much cooking, as there is now. So what if we take in deeply this imperative that he offered? Don't sleep through the revolution. Right now, with no lag time, how does this, the very substance and action of your life, rise to meet this invitation? This call that arrives from all of time, from every corner of your universe, and from the core of your being. Don't sleep through the revolution. I'd like to also place next to this some of the words from Mary Oliver's poem that also will be quite familiar to you, I think, some of you, whole poem. But this little bit of it. When it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom, taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. And that sort of next to, I'll give you some quotes from Dr. King's talk, where he begins by talking about waking up from a 20-year sleep, right? Rip Van Winkle waking up and finding the sign on the King George Tavern changed to George Washington, and it's like, what? You know, who's George Washington? And and who am I and where am I, having slept through? And it's just so poignant that to think right now, if we sleep through the revolution, we're going to wake up dead. You know, it's sort of like it has a different kind of immediacy to it, I think, in a way. But I was noticing that with Mary Oliver's poetic voice in conversation with Dr. King's prophetic one, I'm also hearing the voices of our ancestors in Zen. They have been voices in this conversation for a very long time. And what appeared to my mind first was the evening cautions from retreats that we don't say anymore, the voice of the ancestors. What we used to say was, I beg to urge you, everyone, life and death is a grave matter. All things pass quickly away. Each of us must be completely alert, never neglectful, never indulgent. So those words used to drift into the hall from the hallway right before we would all go to bed. And the tone of them is really deeply countercultural right now, don't you think? It's just, we don't say, each of us must be, you know. It's like, don't tell me what to do. You know, it's just kind of, it's odd to our ears, I think, that kind of attitude. They used to seem unnecessarily harsh to my ear. But they don't kind of right now, because they're sung together with Mary Oliver's softer, you know, more feminine voice, you know, a bride to amazement, a bridegroom, taking the world into my arms. And I've been also having running through my mind this wonderful song that's a water song that some grandmothers not Iroquois, but that nation were teaching to girls, and it's. To me, it's in a way, they're saying, you must sing to the water. You must sing to the water in all the four directions every day. And the song goes, Ni bi wa bo en dayan, ya a ki mis kwi ni bi. There's something about the you must do this every day in the four directions that is to me another presentation of each of us must be completely alert, but with a voice from the heart that you can feel in a little bit different way, singing to the water. I think we need to sing to the water. So, a little bit of what Dr. Kidd was really striking to me. He was speaking to the churches. He was talking to this assembly of the Unitarian Church. Unfortunately, I always forget that when I download these things, they're in like 18, size 18, and if I don't change them before I print them, I use a lot of paper. So he's talking about how Ben Winkle slept through the revolution, and how that there was an idea whose time had come, right, at that time. And we are in this time of an idea whose time has come, an idea of restoring, of participating in restoring the health of Earth and beings on Earth, that our own thriving, our own even surviving depends on being part of restoring. And he says there's nothing more powerful in all the world than an idea whose time has come. And the great question is, what do we do when we find ourselves in such a period? And his responses are very active and at the same time totally rooted in the sense that love is the origin of these actions. So the first thing that he says is, through our scientific genius, we've made of this world a neighborhood, and now, through our moral and ethical commitment, we must make it a brotherhood. We must live together as brothers. I think he would probably modify that language today. Or we will all perish together as fools. And so that he's coming from the awareness that we all are interpermeating, woven together even while we stand individually. And so then he says, secondly, it's necessary to reaffirm over and over again the essential immorality of racial segregation. He goes right to it. How do we create this beloved community? We have to stand up and say it again and again and again and say it out loud and not be shy. Third, to remain awake, it's necessary to refute the idea that there are superior and inferior races. Specifically that. And the next thing that the church must do to remain awake through the revolution is to move out into the arena of social action, to engage in action programs. And he says specifically, don't buy the idea that legislation is never effective, and that while the law may not change the hearts of people, it does change the habits of people. I thought that was a really interesting statement, and true. Sometimes the law can go ahead of the full understanding. And then he goes on to talk about nonviolent resistance and action, and goes into depth about that. And I think I'm not going to dwell on it, but you know that. But he says, as long as these problems are with us, it will be necessary to demonstrate in order to call attention to them and to risk ourselves. To risk ourselves truly. Some things are so eternally true that they are worth dying for. And he makes a very strong statement. If a person has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. That's a strong statement. That's what he said. But then he talks about And this part I bet you've heard about, I'm proud to be maladjusted. Have you all heard that part of the talk? Where he says that that term maladjusted was very much sort of in vogue at the time, psychologically speaking. And he says, there are some things in our nation and in our world to which I'm proud to be maladjusted, and I call upon you to be maladjusted and all people of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. And I wanted to bring that together with what I was saying before. Because that's an interesting word, to be maladjusted. If we're talking, how do we put that next to welcome? And I think there's something very important in there that we need to investigate deeply. How in our meditation, how in our practice of precepts, how in our studies of what's fundamentally real, which is what Buddhism likes to talk about, how do we hold that sky-large sense of welcome with this call to be not adjusted to what really needs to be addressed? How do they work with each other? And I was struck that, at least seems to me anyway, that Buddhism in the West is quite accustomed to being maladjusted. We love to think of ourselves as rebels, as, you know, countercultural, as maladjusted, right? It's kind of our pride and joy, you know. But I wonder if we have maybe too often let that maladjustment remain shallow, trivialized it in a way, and so left it open to being subverted by ego, to serve the self, that is so adept at bending the energy in the interest of constant reassurance. I think it's really easy for that to happen and for us not to stay deep enough in it, in the questioning. What am I maladjusted to? What is that? How is that an open heart? It's so striking that the way Dr. King knew who he served, you know, he knew it in every cell of his body. Another name for being maladjusted. And what is it when we ask ourselves, what or who, to whom do I have allegiance, as John was fond of asking us, who do we serve? Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. Who is that other? Is one of our koans. And I believe that there's a fundamental, a kind of tectonic plate shift that's happening for many people right now. And that is that we know who we serve. I think we know that our hearts deeply long to serve life, to serve loving. Just as it is, the very life that we're woven into, not the one that we think is ideal, but this very one that we have. And that's what I think over the next 6 months, my teaching at least will be bent to exploring this. Finding openness in our own hearts. Let's count the ways that we do this, drawing from all the sources and exploring the wealth in our own Zen kitchen. So yeah, we have time for conversation.